Gri Gorsuni are discussing is the Charles Tilley Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Sebu and the organizers, for giving me an impossible task to comment on 6 papers in just a few minutes. Today was a really interesting day, and I think everyone should be congratulated for a really wonderful conference and for sticking with it. And those of you who are here today, you marathon sitters and thinkers, I think I want to congratulate you. We're almost to the end. As Tolya put it, Buddha geçer, this too will pass. So what were the themes of today? How can one unify today, and particularly this panel? Well, in some sense, we've come to a funeral. This is the funeral. We have come here today to bury the old Ottoman history, to talk about a new way of looking at the complexities, the integrations of the Ottoman Empire, and how in that empire, those relationships ultimately broke down and led to the disasters of the genocide of which we spoke this morning. In the old historiography, which I remember fighting against many, many decades ago, basically history was complicit in the project of nation-making. Indeed, modern historiography begins in the 19th century or in the late 18th century, and in the views of people like Leopold von Ranke, as part of the project of nationalism and the nation. And yet, those of us who study the Russian Empire or the Ottoman Empire are faced with this greater complexity of this multinational, or what's being used today, the word cosmopolitan, setting. In his talk, Sebu mentioned some of the definitions of the way we could understand empire. Empire is a multinational, complex formation, political formation, in which difference, distinction, is institutionalized, and in which distinction and difference is maintained precisely because it gives legitimacy to those people who are superior to rule over those who are inferior. So two things mark empire: difference, institutionalized difference, and superordination of some and subordination of others. And you can think of it easily in an overseas empire like India, where the British are the civilized people and the Indians, the locals, the natives, are those to be civilized in a mission civilisatrice, right? Is so different from the nation state, which at least in its ideal form is about not difference and inequality, but about homogeneity, we're all the same, and not only homogeneity, but equality. That is, instead of subjects, you have citizens. So we're dealing with something fundamentally different from a nation state, but one that's going to break up in the very periods that we're looking up into a bunch of nation states, though that process will ultimately not be completed till well after the Second World War. And each of the papers in the panel that I'm to discuss talk about the complex interrelations between the peoples of this empire. If you think of Sebu's paper, which we heard so many hours ago, this was about literary struggles, about a dictionary. Oh, those Hagarites, I never knew what those Hagarites were, but there they were the Turks, and the way in which Armenians were negotiating and dealing with this difficult problem of people who had either lost what they considered their native language and a way to teach them about this language. Now that struggle and that formation of that particular dictionary and the hundreds of texts that would follow in Armeno-Turkish and other forms, is really about trying to create a new Armenian identity, or in the way they might put it, to restore a lost Armenian identity. So the need to revive the Armenian language among Ottoman Armenians to keep them from losing what was distinctive to them was the task that these Mukhtaris and others set out for themselves, and they chose to do it with these Armeno-Turkish texts, that is, trying to teach Anatolian Turkish-speaking Armenians, in fact, their own language. In Murat Yildiz's paper, we have an even more graphic and gorgeous, I love some of those figures, they were beautiful. I wish I could look like that. In Murat's paper, he took the example and the sort of focus and locus of sport to show how there were certain shared ideas of corporal beauty, of masculinity, of proper middle class behavior, but at the same time, they never completely come together. There's always separation. These various clubs are largely, not always, organized separately. So there's not that, this isn't the old image of a kind of harmony between the millets, of full tolerance. Again, this is an empire. This is about difference that can be experienced and is lived with, and which is institutionalized and enforced, and inequality. And the Armenians and other gavur, other infidels, are supposed to be below the believers, the Muslims. One of the problems is, though, that status hierarchy is being reversed in the imaginary of both these non-Muslims, who think they're more civilized than Muslims, and the Muslims, who become resentful that they should be on top, and now they find themselves below. So this is very, very important. It's not an image in these papers of harmony, but of what you might think of as coexistence, of getting by in this difficult situation. And think of coexistence, that was the word that was used during the Khrushchev era, the United States and the Soviet Union, two totally different systems, one communist, one capitalist, had to somehow live in this on the same globe without blowing each other apart. Didn't work out so well, but at least they kept the peace. So that seems to me is a better way of understanding how these ethno-religious communities managed to stay together. In some of the papers, we've sort of buried in many ways these national historiographies, but they'll never completely disappear, and they'll never completely be eliminated from our imaginary. Nationalism and national history is like those monsters in those slasher movies, right? You kill that Freddy Krueger over and over again, but suddenly when you least expect it, he leaps up. They're like vampires, and they're going to be with us for a very long time. But the struggle is worth engaging in. The other monster, it seems to me, is this vague notion that can be used to explain almost everything, and that is the term modernity. Now, modernity is not a single or simple thing. It is, in fact, a discourse. It's a way people describe themselves, describe others, describe the times they live in, praise themselves, put down others as antique, ancient, old-fashioned, traditional, or whatever. And it can describe all kinds of different things. So the nation state, in some imaginaries, is the more modern. Oh, cosmopolitanism, or in a Marxist term, internationalism, just the opposite of the nation state, is modernity. Take your pick, whatever you want. Murad, in fact, talked about, in some ways, these people's own image of modernity, and it was an interesting one, because it seemed to be connected to things that we would consider modern, at least in the West. And that is strength, health, hygiene, I imagine cleanliness, no hair on the chest, things like that. A new kind of morality, hardness rather than softness. This image and the images of those guys with those biceps across their chest and so forth is a small step, it seems to me, to things like competition, winning, beating others, military training, war. And I wonder what happened to these men. And I wonder how much of this image, in fact, which we would associate with Marines maybe, or military training, in fact was implied in these images and in these practices. What happens to homosexuality? Where's the gay? Were their fears implied in some of those pictures of those muscular men? Were there fears of a sexuality that might undermine that ideal of masculinity, this warrior ideal? And notice, and Murat had this very nicely in his paper, not only is there some kind of assertion of a new, strong, hard modernity, but there's a fear underneath this, and that is fear of degeneration, of decay as well, from some kind of earlier ideal, in comparison, you remember, with the English, as he mentioned it. In Vazgen's wonderful exploration of images, and I'm not an art historian, and I always feel very trepidatious trespassing in those fields, because I think that's a distinct kind of methodology with which I am not very familiar. But as I was looking at those images of Ani and a woman in traditional dress, and then the images of a Muslim woman or of the battle scene, I was thinking that sometimes these people walked one way toward the national, toward some ethno-religious celebration, and at the other times moved quite effortlessly towards images that would be more conversant with what you could call the imperial or the cosmopolitan. And both of them, again, as most of these papers argue, seem to work somehow together. Vazgen talked about a global perspective. What we seem to have here is an imperial perspective, that is, bringing the empire in its transnational being in conversation with its various parts. But what I would ask methodologically, and I think you're doing this in your dissertation, is where in this display tonight, and maybe you'll add it next time you do the talk, are the non-Armenian artists? That is, what about Turkish or Kurdish or any other Jewish artists? Would they have painted and acted with similar styles and similar themes? Now, what we saw in the second part of this panel today was an extraordinary development. That is something that I had hoped to encourage students maybe 20 or 30 years ago when I first came to teach Armenian history at the University of Michigan to engage in. But it took a long time before people like Richard Antaramyan and Zovinar and Tolga and others and Nora began to do it. And that is to try to work toward a history of Eastern Anatolia. There was one article years ago when there wasn't much to read. You could read stuff on Eastern Anatolia and the Armenian genocide in a semester. That's how little there was at that time. There was an article by a guy named Stephen Dugid, D-U-G-U-I-D. I don't know what happened to him or who he is anymore, but it was about a kind of triangular or maybe four-sided relationship between Kurds, nomadic Kurds, Armenians, townspeople, and the Ottoman government, and trying to deal with the complexities of this Eastern Anatolian social and political ecology. And that was it. And now suddenly, these guys are giving us the depth, what I would call the social texture of this area. And beginning with Zovinar, she questions seriously early in her paper the rigidity of the categories with which we have been brought up, the essentialization of the peoples that we're dealing with. In her own paper, which I think is just wonderful, and her close and careful reading of the document which she showed you, the first thing I noticed was there was no redress, no way to solve your problems locally for the crimes of this Khachadur, a wealthy and presumably powerful man. There wasn't a place to go to the church, to the state. And so these guys, these Armenians, decide to go all the way to Istanbul to the Patriarchate. Khachadur, is an Armenian. My grandmother would say he couldn't have been Armenian because my grandmother told me there are no bad Armenians. You know, they don't commit crimes and they're just not bad. And that image, this is a woman, uneducated woman from Diyarbakir, from Dikranakir, that was one of the powerful things that she and others like her felt, and I believed it until I went to graduate school. So Khachadur is an Armenian, but he's not identified as such, but as being like Kurds or ancient Israeli unlawful elders. That's really interesting. That the imaginary, they can't imagine that an Armenian, that could closely link an Armenian with this kind of evil. She talks there about Armenian subjectivity, and this I think is so important. And if there's something lacking in the recent book I put, I do talk about, but not enough, I think, Armenian subjectivity. I talk about the affective disposition, the mental and emotional universe of the Young Turks and others, but one has to also talk about the Armenians as well. And these younger folks are going to do that work. But what she comes up with is that Armenian self-images are about a lawful community, about well-educated, civilized people who are united. They come together to protect their nation, their victims, and to push out wrongdoers. And they feel this unity. Now, when Tolga comes and talks about the Armenians of Garin, of Erzurum and Erzincan, what you find there is an emphasis appropriately not only on the self-image of Armenians, but on the social realities of division, of conflict, of exploitation, which is going on as well. You would think that Soviet Armenians with their Marxist background would have written more about this, though they spent most of their attention on Caucasian Armenia rather than this part of Armenia. Seems to me both of these things have to come together. The discourses, the ways they see themselves, and as much as we can then recover from below what's actually going on. And Tolga has turned his lens toward the complexities of the local, of the provincial, and found the serious cleavages in Armenian society. Nora has taken this wonderful example of her own, is it grandfather?
Great-grandfather.
I actually read this essay for the journal and immediately recommended it for publication, and then I think I took a piece of it and stuck it in my book as well. So she shows here again the texture of life, Armenian agency, their own making of decisions, the complex interpersonal relationships between them. And by showing this texture of life, this is not just apricots and dolma here, this is the kind of thing that Vahetascan's Hushamadyan site also shows. The beauties, here we're dealing with a very deep culture that's been formed through a millennia and which was existing and working and acting within the Ottoman Empire and desired a better life within that empire. Most Armenians were not pulling for separation and independence. A few were, of course. They were looking for a way to live within this empire, but to be protected by their own government and prosper as such. We have now been able, in our historiography, this is the last thing I will be saying, to break down the walls between the national histories. But what I couldn't do in my book, and what I think we're groping toward in this panel, is trying to work out the difficulties, the complexities, contradictions, conflicts, and cooperations between these various Ottoman communities. And that's hard to negotiate, you know? And different people in different layers of social life or position, the church, revolutionaries, immigrants, merchants, peasants, craftsmen, will have different attitudes. And that all that complexity has to be, it seems to me, articulated. What we see in these wonderful papers, and indeed through much of today, is that what there was before 1915 was a real, complex Armenian-Ottoman society. And what happened in 1915 in the genocide was not only the mass murder of hundreds of thousands of people, but the destruction of a whole unique civilization. Thank you.